face. "Why, it's Mrs. Nussbaum," Roger cries, the same way he's heard Fred Allen do Wednesday nights over the BBC.
"You were expecting maybe Lessie?"
replies the dog. Roger can smell ether fumes quite strongly as he starts his cautious descent.
"Come on, mate. It'll be over before you know it. Pointsman just wants to count the old drops of saliva, that's all. Wants to make a wee incision in your cheek. Nice glass tube, nothing to bother about, right? Ring a bell now and then. Exciting world of the laboratory, you'll love it."
Ether seems to be getting to him. He tries to stop her the flask, takes a step, foot plunges into a hole. Lurching sideways, he gropes for something to steady himself. The stopper falls back out of the flask and in forever among the debris at the bottom of the smashed house. Overhead, pointsman cries,
"This sponge, Mexico, you forgot the sponge!"
Down comes a round, pale collection of holes, bouncing in and out of the light of the flash.
"Frisky chap,"
Roger making a two-handed grab for it, splashing ether liberally about. He locates the sponge at last in his flashlight beam, the dog looking on from the pram in some confusion.
"Ha!"
pouring ether to drench the sponge and go wisping cold off his hand till the flask's empty. Taking the wet sponge between two fingers, he staggers toward the dog, shining the light up from under his chin to highlight the vampire face he thinks he's making.
"Moment of truth."
He lunges. The dog leaps off at an angle, streaking past Roger toward the entrance while Roger keeps going with his sponge headfirst into the pram, which collapses under his weight. Dimly, he hears the doctor above whimper,
"He's getting away, Mexico, do hurry. Hurry."
Roger, clutching the sponge, extricates himself from the infant's vehicle, taking it off as if it were a shirt with what seems to him not unathletic skill.
"Mexico!"
Plaintive. Right, Roger, blundering up the cellar's rubble to the outside again, where he beholds the doctor closing in on the dog, net held aloft and outspread. Rain falls persistently over this tableau. Roger circles so as to make with pointsman a pincer upon the animal, who now stands with paws planted and teeth showing near one of the pieces of rear wall still standing. Jessica waits halfway into it, hands in her pockets, smoking, watching.
"Here," hollers the sentry. You idiots, keep away from that bit of wall. There's nothing to hold it up."
"Do you have any cigarettes?" asks Jessica.
"He's going to bolt," Roger screams. "For God's sake, Mexico, slowly now."
Testing each footstep, they move upslope over the ruin's delicate balance. It's a system of lever arms that can plunge them into deadly collapse at any moment. They draw near their quarry, who scrutinizes now the doctor, now Roger, with quick shifts of his head. He growls tentatively, tail keeping up a steady slap against the two sides of the corner they've backed him into. As Roger, who carries the light, moves rearward, the dog, some circuit of him, recalls the other light that came from behind in recent days, the light that followed the great blast so seethed through afterward by pain and cold. Light from the rear signals death. Men with nets about to leap can be avoided.
"Sponge!"
screams the doctor. Roger flings himself at the dog, who has taken off in pointsman's direction and away toward the street, whilst pointsman, groaning, swings his toilet bowl foot desperately, misses, momentum carrying him around a full turn, net up like a radar antenna. Roger, snoot full of ether, can't check his lunge. As the doctor comes spinning round again, Roger careens on into him, toilet bowl hitting Roger a painful thump in the leg. The two men fall over, tangled in the net now covering them. Broken beams creak, chunks of rain-wet plaster tumble. Above them, the unsupported wall begins to sway.
"Get out of there,"
hollers the sentry. But the efforts of the pair under the net to move away only rock the wall more violently.
"We're for it,"
the doctor shivers. Roger seeks his eyes to see if he means it, but the window of the balaclava helmet now contains only a white ear and fringe of hair.
"Roll,"
Roger suggests. They contrive to roll a few yards down toward the street, by which time part of the wall has collapsed in the other direction. They manage to get back to Jessica without causing any more damage.
"He's run down the street,"
she mentions, helping them out of the net.
"It's all right," the doctor sighs. "It doesn't make any difference." "Ah, but the evening's young,"
from Roger.
No, forget it. "What will you do for a dog, then?"
They are underway again. Roger at the wheel, Jessica between them, toilet bowl out a half-open door before the answer.
"Perhaps it's a sign. Perhaps I should be branching out."
Roger gives him a quick look. "Silence, Mexico. Try not to think about what that means. He's not one's superior, after all. Both report to the old brigadier at the White Visitation on, so far as he knows, equal footing. But sometimes, Roger glances again across Jessica's dark wool bosom at the knitted head, the naked nose and eyes. He thinks the doctor wants more than his goodwill, his collaboration, but wants him, as one wants a fine specimen of dog. Why is he here, then, assisting at yet another dog napping? What stranger does he shelter in him so mad?
Will you be going back down tonight, Doctor? The young lady needs a ride.
I shan't. I'll be staying in, but you might take the car back. I must talk with Dr. Spectro. They are approaching now a lengthy brick improvisation, a Victorian paraphrase of what once, long ago, resulted in Gothic cathedrals, but which, in its own time, arose not from any need to climb through the fashioning of suitable confusions toward any apical god, but more in a derangement of aim, a doubt as to the god's actual locus, or in some as to its very existence, out of a cruel network of sensuous moments that could not be transcended, and so bent the intentions of the builders not in any zenith, but back to fright, to simple escape, in whatever direction, from what the industrial smoke, street excrement, windowless warrens, shrugging leather forests of drive belts, flowing and patient shadow states of the rats and flies were saying about the chances for mercy that year. The grimed brick sprawl is known as the Hospital of St. Veronica, of the true image for colonic and respiratory diseases, and one of its residents is a Dr. Kevin Spectro, neurologist and casual Pavlovian. Spectro is one of the original seven owners of the book, and if you ask Mr. Pointsman what book, you'll only get smirked at. It rotates the mysterious book among its co-owners on a weekly basis, and this, Roger gathers, is Spectro's week to get dropped in on at all hours. Others, in Pointsman's weeks, have come the same way to the White Visitation in the night. Roger has heard their earnest conspirators whispering in the corridors, the smart rattle of all their shoes like dancing pumps on marble, destroying one's repose, refusing ever to die with distance, Pointsman's voice and stride always distinct from the rest. How is it going to sound now with a toilet bowl? Roger and Jessica leave the doctor at a side entrance into which he melts, leaving nothing but rain dripping from slopes and serifs of an unreadable legend on the lintel. They turn southward. Lights on the dash glow warmly. Searchlights rake the raining sky. The slender machine shivers over the roads. Jessica drifts toward sleep, the leather seat creaking as she curls about. Windscreen wipers brush the rain in a rhythmic bright warp. It is past two, and time for home. Inside St. Veronica's hospital, they sit together just off the war neurosis ward, these habitual evenings. The autoclave simmers its fine clutter of steel bones. Steam drifts into the glare of the gooseneck lamp, now and then becoming very bright, and the shadows of the men's gestures may pass through it, knife-edged, swooping very fast. But both faces are usually reserved, kept well back in the annulus of night. Out of the blackness of the ward, a half-open file drawer of pain, each bed a folder, come cries, struck cries as from cold metal. Kevin Spectro will take his syringe and spike away a dozen times tonight, into the dark, to sedate Fox, his generic term for any patient. Run three times around the building without thinking of a fox and you can cure anything. Pointsmen will sit each time waiting for their talking to resume, glad to rest these moments in the half-darkness, the worn gold-leaf letters shining from the spines of books, the fragrant coffee mess besieged by roaches, the winter rain in the downspout just outside the window.
You're not looking any better. Ah, it's the old bastard again. He's got me down. This fighting Spectro. Every day I don't...
Pouting downward at his eyeglasses that he's wiping on his shirt.
There's more to damned pudding than I can see. He's always springing his senile little surprises. It's his age, really. Oh, that I can deal with, but he's so damned... such a bastard. He never sleeps. He plots.
Not senility, no. I meant the position he's working from.
Pointsman, you don't have the priorities he does quite yet, do you? You can't take the chances he can. You've treated them that age. Surely you know that strange smugness.
Pointsman's own fox waits out in the city, a prize of war. In here, the tiny office space is the cave of an oracle. Steam drifting, sibilant cries arriving out of the darkness. Abreactions of the Lord of the Night.
I don't like it, Pointsman, since you did ask.
Why not? Silence.
Unethical? For pity's sake, is this ethical?
Raising an arm, then toward the exit into the ward, almost a fascist salute.
No, I'm only trying to think of ways to justify it. Experimentally, I can't. It's only one man.
It's Slothrop. You know what he is. Even Mexico thinks, oh, the usual, precognition, psychokinesis. They have their own problems, that lot. But suppose you had the chance to study a truly classical case of some pathology, a perfect mechanism.
One night, Spectro asked, if he hadn't been one of Laszlo Jamf's subjects, would you be all this keen on him?
Of course I would.
Hmm.
Imagine a missile one hears approaching only after it explodes. The reversal. A piece of time neatly snipped out. A few feet of film run backwards. The blast of the rocket, fallen faster than sound, then growing out of it, the roar of its own fall catching up to what's already death and burning, a ghost in the sky. Pavlov was fascinated with ideas of the opposite. Call it a cluster of cells somewhere on the cortex of the brain, helping to distinguish pleasure from pain, light from dark, dominance from submission. But when somehow starve them, traumatize, shock, castrate them, send them over into one of the transmarginal phases, past borders of their waking selves, past equivalent and paradoxical phases, you weaken this idea of the opposite. And here all at once is the paranoid patient who would be master yet now feels himself a slave, who would be loved but suffers his world's indifference. And I think, Pavlov, writing to Janet, it is precisely the ultra-paradoxical phase which is the base of the weakening of the idea of the opposite in our patients. Our madmen, our paranoid, maniac, schizoid, morally imbecile.
Spectro shakes his head.
You're putting response before stimulus.
Not at all. Think of it.
He's out there, and he can feel them coming, days in advance. But it's a reflex to something that's in the air right now, something we're too coarsely put together to sense, but Slothrop can.
But that makes it extrasensory.
Why not say a sensory cue we just aren't paying attention to? Something that's been there all along, something we could be looking at, but no one is. Often in our experiments, I believe M.K. Petrova was first to observe it, one of the women, quite early in the game, really, the act merely of bringing the dog into the laboratory, especially in our experimental neurosis work, the first sight of the test stand, of the technician, a stray shadow, the touch of a draft of air, some cue we might never pin down would be enough to send him over, send him transmarginal.
So, Slothrop, conceivably, out in the city, the ambience alone. Suppose we consider the war itself as a laboratory. When the V-2 hits, you see, first the blast, then the sound of its falling, the normal order of the stimuli reversed that way, so he might turn a particular corner, enter a certain street, and for no clear reason feel suddenly...
Silence comes in, sculptured by spoken dreams, by pain voices of the rocket-bombed next door, Lord of the Night's children, voices hung upon the ward's stagnant medicinal air, praying to their master. Sooner or later, an abreaction, each one, all over this frost and harrowed city. As once again the floor is a giant lift propelling you with no warning toward your ceiling, replaying now as the walls are blown outward bricks and mortar showering down, your sudden paralysis as death comes to wrap and stun. I don't know, Gov. I must have blacked out when I come to. She was gone. It was burning all around me. Head was full of smoke. And the sight of your blood spurting from the flaccid stub of artery, the snowy roof slates fallen across half your bed, the cinema kiss never completed, you were pinned and stared at a crumpled cigarette pack for 2 hours in pain. You could hear them crying from the rows either side, but couldn't move. The sudden light filling up the room, the awful silence, brighter than any morning through blankets turned to gauze, no shadows at all, only unutterable 2 o'clock dawn, and this transmarginal leap, this surrender, where ideas of the opposite have come together and lost their oppositeness. And is it really the rocket explosion that Slothrop's keying on, or is it exactly this depolarizing, this neurotic confusion that fills the wards tonight? How many times before it's washed away, these iterations that pour out, reliving the blast, afraid to let go because the letting go is so final? How do I know, Doctor, that I'll ever come back? And they answer, trust us, after the rocket is so hollow. Only mummery, trust you? And both know it. Spectro feels so like a fraud, but carries on only because the pain continues to be real. And those who do let go at last, out of each catharsis rise new children, painless, egoless for one pulse of the between, tablet erased, new writing about to begin, hand and chalk poised in winter gloom over these poor human palimpsests shivering under their government blankets, drugged, drowning in tears and snot of grief so real, torn from so deep that it surprises, seems more than their own. How Pointsman lusts after them, pretty children. Those drab undershorts of his are full to bursting with need humorlessly, worldly, to use their innocence, to write on them new words of himself, his own brown realpolitik dreams. Some psychic prostate ever in aching love promised, ah, hinted but till now. How seductively they lie ranked in their iron bedsteads, their virginal sheets, the darlings so artlessly erotic. St. Veronica's downtown bus station, their crossroads, newly arrived on this fake parquetry, chewing gum, scuffed, charcoal black, slicks of nighttime vomit, pale yellow, clear as the fluids of gods, waste newspapers or propaganda leaflets no one has read in torn, scythe-shaped pieces, old nose pickings, black grime that blows weakly in when the doors open. You have waited in these places into the early mornings, sinked into the unwhitening of the interior. You know the arrivals schedule by heart, by hollow heart, and where these children have run away from, and that in this city there is no one to meet them. You impress them with your gentleness. You've never quite decided if they can see through to your vacuum. They won't yet look in your eyes. Their slender legs are never still. Knitted stockings droop. All elastic has gone to war. But charmingly, little heels kick restless against the canvas bags, the fraying valises under the wood bench. Speakers in the ceiling report departures and arrivals in English, then in the other exile languages. Tonight's child has had a long trip here, hasn't slept. Her eyes are red, her frock wrinkled. Her coat has been a pillow. You feel her exhaustion, feel the impossible vastness of all the sleeping countryside at her back. And for the moment, you really are selfless, sexless, considering only how to shelter her. You are the traveler's aid. Behind you, long, night-long queues of men in uniform move away slowly, kicking AWOL bags along, mostly silent, toward exit doors painted beige but with edges smudged browner in bell curves of farewell by the generation of hands. Doors that only now and then open, let in the cold air, take out a certain draft of men and close again. A driver or a clerk stands by the door checking tickets, passes, furlough chits. One by one, men step out into this perfectly black rectangle of night and disappear. Gone, the war taking them. The man behind already presenting his ticket. Outside, motors are roaring, but less like transport than like some kind of stationary machine. Very low earthquake frequencies coming in mixed with the cold, somehow intimating that out there your blindness after this bright indoors will be like a sudden blow. Soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, one by one, gone. Those who happen to be smoking might last an instant longer. Weak little coal swinging in orange arc once, twice, no more. You sit, half-turned to watch them, your soiled, sleepy darling beginning to complain, and it's no use. How can your lusts fit inside this same white frame with so much such endless departure? 1,000 children are shuffling out these doors tonight. But only rare nights will even one come in, home to your sprung, spermy bed. The wind over the gas works. Closer smells of mold on wet coffee grounds catch at pale sweaters with the pits heaped in a corner in some accidental gesture, slink or embrace. This wordless, ratcheting cue, thousands going away, only the stray freak particle by accident drifting against the major flow. Yet for all his agonizing, all pointsmen will score, presently, is an octopus. Yes, a gigantic horror movie devilfish, name of Grigori. Gray, slimy, never still, shivering slow motion in his makeshift pen down by the Ick Regis jetty. A terrible wind that day off the channel. Pointsman in his balaclava helmet, eyes freezing. Dr. Porkyevich with greatcoat collar up and fur hat down around his ears. Their breaths foul with hours-old fish. And what the hell can pointsmen do with this animal? Already by itself, the anther is growing. One moment, a featureless blastulobob, the next folding beginning to differentiate. One of the things Spectro said that night, surely it was that night, was, I only wondered if you'd feel the same way without all those dogs about, if your subjects all along had been human. You ought to be offering me one or two, then, instead of, are you serious, giant octopi? The doctors are watching each other closely. I wonder what you'll do. So do I. Take the octopus. Does he mean forget Slothrop? A charged moment. But then pointsman laughs the well-known laugh that's done him yeoman service in a profession where too often it's hedge or hang. I'm always being told to take animals. He means that years ago, a colleague, gone now, told him he'd be more human, warmer, if he kept a dog of his own outside the lab. Pointsman tried. God knows he did. It was a Springer Spaniel named Gloucester. Pleasant enough animal, he supposed, but the try lasted less than a month. What finally irritated him out of all tolerance was that the dog didn't know how to reverse its behavior. It could open doors to the rain and the spring insects, but not close them. Knock over garbage, vomit on the floor, but not clean it up. How could anyone live with such a creature? Octopi, Spectro wheedles, are docile under surgery. They can survive massive removals of brain tissue. Their unconditioned response to prey is very reliable. Show them a crab, wham, out revealed, tentacle, home to poisoning and supper. And, pointsman, they don't bark. Oh, but... No, tanks, pumps, filtering, special food, that may be fine up in Cambridge, that lot, but everyone here's so damned tight-fisted, it's the damned Rundstedt offensive. Has to be. PWE won't fund anything now unless it pays off tactically, immediately, last week, you know, if not sooner. No, an octopus is much too elaborate. Not even pudding would buy it. No, not even old delusions of grandeur himself. No limit to the things you can teach them. Spectro, you're not the devil. Looking closer. Are you? You know we're set for sound stimuli. The whole thrust of this Slothrop scheme has to be auditory. The reversal is auditory. I've seen an octopus brain or two in my time, mate, and don't think I haven't noticed those great blooming optic lobes, eh? You're trying to palm off a visual creature on me. What's there to see when the damn things come down?
The glow.
Eh? A fiery red ball falling like a meteor. Rot. When Hidwee saw one the other night over Deptford. What I want, pointsman leaning now into the central radiance of the lamp, his white face more vulnerable than his voice, whispering across the burning spire of a hypodermic set upright on the desk. What I really need is not a dog, not an octopus, but one of your fine foxes. Damn it! One little fox. Something's stalking through the city of smoke, gathering up slender girls, fair and smooth as dolls by the handful. Their piteous cries, their dollful and piteous cries. The face of one is suddenly very close, and down, over the staring eyes, come cream lids with stiff lashes, slamming loudly shut. The long reverberating of lead counterweights tumble inside her head as Jessica's own lids now come flying open. She surfaces in time to hear the last echoes blowing away on the heels of the blast, austere and keen, a winter sound. Roger wakes up briefly, too, mutters something like fucking madness, and nods back to sleep. She reaches out, blind little hand grazing the ticking clock, the worn plush stomach of her panda, Michael, an empty milk bottle holding scarlet blossoms from a spurge in a garden a mile down the road. Reaches to where her cigarettes ought to be but aren't. Halfway out now from under the covers, she hangs between the two worlds, a white athletic tension in this cold room. Oh, well. She leaves him in their warm burrow, moves, shivering, blah, 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 in grainy darkness over winter-tight floorboards, slick as ice to her bare soles. Her cigarettes are on the parlor floor, left among pillows in front of the fire. Roger's clothing is scattered all about. Puffing on a cigarette, squinting with one eye for the smoke, she tidies up, folding his trousers, hanging up his shirt. Then wanders to the window, lifts the blackout curtain, tries to see out through frost gathering on the panes, out into the snow tracked over by foxes, rabbits, long-lost dogs, and winter birds, but no humans. Empty canals of snow thread away into trees and town whose name they still don't know. She cups the cigarette in her palm, leery of showing a light, though blackout was lifted weeks and weeks ago, already part of another time and world. Late lorry motors rush north and south in the night, and airplanes fill the sky, then drain away east to some kind of quiet. Could they have settled for hotels? RE forms being frisked for cameras and binoculars? This house, town, crossed arcs of Roger and Jessica are so vulnerable to German weapons and to British bylaws. It doesn't feel like danger here, but she does wish there were others about, and that it could really be a village, her village. The searchlights could stay to light the night, and barrage balloons to populate fat and friendly the daybreak. Everything, even the explosions in the distances, might stay as long as they were to no purpose. As long as no one had to die. Couldn't it be that way? Only excitement, sound and light, a storm approaching in the summer, to live in a world where that would be the day's excitement. Only kind thunder. Jessica has floated out of herself, up to watch herself watching the night, to hover in wide-legged, shoulder-padded white, satin-polished on her nightward surfaces. Until something falls here, close enough to matter, they do have their safety. Their thickets of silver-blue stalks reaching after dark to touch or sweep clouds. The green-brown masses in uniform at the ends of afternoons, stone, eyes on the distances, bound in convoy for fronts, for high destinies that have, strangely, so little to do with the two of them here. Don't you know there's a war on, moron? Yes, but here's Jessica in her sister's hand-me-down pajamas, and Roger asleep in nothing at all. But where is the war? Until it touch them. Until something falls. A doodle will give time to get to safety. A rocket will hit before they can hear it coming. Biblical, maybe, spooky as an old northern fairy tale, but not the war, not the great struggle of good and evil the wireless reports every day. And no reason not just to, well, to keep on. Roger has tried to explain to her the V-bomb statistics. the difference between distribution in Angel's eye view over the map of England and their own chances as seen from down here. She's almost got it, nearly understands his Poisson equation, yet can't quite put the two together, put her own enforced calm day-to-day alongside the pure numbers and keep them both in sight. Pieces keep slipping in and out. Why is your equation only for angels, Roger? Why can't we do something down here? Couldn't there be an equation for us too, something to help us find a safer place? Why am I surrounded, his usual understanding self today, by statistical illiterates? There's no way, love. Not as long as the mean density of strikes is constant. Pointsman doesn't even understand that. The rockets are distributing about London just as Poisson's equation in the textbooks predicts. As the data keep coming in, Roger looks more and more like a prophet. Side-section people stare after him in the hallways. It's not precognition. He wants to make an announcement in the cafeteria or something. Have I ever pretended to be anything I'm not? All I'm doing is plugging numbers into a well-known equation. You can look it up in the book and do it yourself. His little bureau is dominated now by a glimmering map, a window into another landscape than Winter Sussex, written names and spidering streets, an ink ghost of London, ruled off into 576 squares, a quarter square kilometer each. Rocket strikes are represented by red circles. The Poisson equation will tell, for a number of total hits arbitrarily chosen, how many squares will get none, how many one, two, three, and so on. An Erlenmeyer flask bubbles on the ring. Blue light goes rattling, re-knotting through the seed flow inside the glass. Ancient, tatty textbooks and mathematical papers lie scattered about on desk and floor. Somewhere a snapshot of Jessica peeks from beneath Roger's old Whittaker and Watson. The graying Pavlovian, en route with his tautened gait, thin as a needle, in the mornings to his lab where dogs wait with cheeks laid open, winter silver drops welling from each neat raw fistula to fill the wax cup or graduated tube, pauses by Mexico's open door. The air beyond is blue from cigarettes smoked, and as fag ends later in the freezing black morning shifts re-smoked, a stale and loathsome atmosphere, but he must go in, must face the habitual morning cup. Both know how strange their liaison must look. If ever the anti-pointsman existed, Roger Mexico is the man. Not so much, the doctor admits, for the psychical research. The young statistician is devoted to number and to method, not table-rapping or wishful thinking, but in the domain of zero to one, not something to something, pointsmen can only possess the zero and the one. He cannot, like Mexico, survive any place in between. Like his master, I.P. Pavlov, before him, he imagines the cortex of the brain as a mosaic of tiny, on-off elements. Some are always in bright excitation, others inhibited. The contours, bright and dark, keep changing, but each point is allowed only the two states, waking or sleep, one or zero. Summation, transition, irradiation, concentration, reciprocal induction, all Pavlovian brain mechanics, assumes the presence of these bi-stable points, but to Mexico belongs the domain between zero and one. The middle, pointsman has excluded from his persuasion, the probabilities. The chance of 0.37 that by the time he stops his count, a given square on his map will have suffered only one hit, 0.17 that it will suffer two. Can't you tell? Pointsman offering Mexico one of his Kyprinos Orients, which he guards in secret fag fobs sewn inside all his lab coats. From your map here, which places would be safest to go into, safest from attack? No. But surely every square is just as likely to get hit again. The hits aren't clustering. Mean density is constant. Nothing on the map to the contrary. Only a classical Poisson distribution, quietly, neatly sifting among the squares exactly as it should, growing to its predicted shape. But squares that have already had several hits, I'm sorry, that's the Monte Carlo fallacy. No matter how many have fallen inside a particular square, the odds remain the same as they always were. Each hit is independent of all the others. Bombs are not dogs. No link, no memory, no conditioning. Nice thing to tell a Pavlovian. Is it Mexico's usual priggish insensitivity, or does he know what he's saying? If there is nothing to link the rocket strikes, no reflex arc, no law of negative induction, then he goes into Mexico each morning as to painful surgery, spooked more and more by the choir boy look, the college pleasantries. But it's a visit he must make. How can Mexico play so at his ease with these symbols of randomness and fright? Innocent as a child, perhaps unaware, perhaps that in this play he wrecks the elegant rooms of history, threatens the idea of cause and effect itself. What if Mexico's whole generation have turned out like this? Will post-war be nothing but events, newly created one moment to the next? No links? Is it the end of history? The Romans, Roger and the Reverend Dr. Paul de la Nuit, were drunk together one night, or the vicar was. The ancient Roman priests laid a sieve in the road and then waited to see which stalks of grass would come up through the holes. Roger saw the connection immediately. I wonder, reaching for pocket after pocket, why are there never any damned... Ah, here. If it would follow a poisson, let's see. Mexico, leaning forward, definitely hostile. They used the stalks that grew through the holes to cure the sick. The sieve was a very sacred item to them. What will you do with the sieve you've laid over London? How will you use the things that grow in your network of death? I don't follow you. It's just an equation. Roger really wants other people to know what he's talking about. Jessica understands that. When they don't, his face often grows chalky and clouded, as behind the smudged glass of a railway carriage window, as vaguely silvered barriers come down, spaces slide in to separate him that much more, thinning further his loneliness. She knew their very first day, he leaning across to open the Jaguar door, and so sure she'd never get in, she saw his loneliness. In his face, between his red, nail-bitten hands. Well, it isn't fair. It's eminently fair. Roger, now cynical, looking very young, she thinks. Everyone's equal, same chances of getting hit, equal in the eyes of the rocket. To which she gives him her Fay Wray look, eyes round as can be, red mouth about to open in a scream till he has to laugh. Oh, stop. Sometimes, but what does she want to say? That he must always be lovable, in need of her, and never as now the hovering statistical cherub who's never quite been to hell but speaks as if he's one of the most fallen. Cheap nihilism is Captain Prentice's name for that. It was one day by the frozen pond near the White Visitation, Roger off sucking icicles, lying flat and waving his arms to make angels in the snow, larking. Do you mean that he hasn't paid? Looking up, up, Pirate's wind-burned face seeming to end in the sky, her own hair finally in the way of his gray, reserved eyes. He was Roger's friend. He wasn't playing or undermining, didn't know the first thing she guessed about such dancing shoe wars, and anyway didn't have to because she was already terrible flirt. Well, nothing serious, but those eyes she could never quite see into were so swoony, so utterly terrific, really. The more V-2s over there waiting to be fired over here, Captain Prentice said, obviously the better his chances of catching one. Of course you can't say he's not paying a minimum dues, but aren't we all? Well, Roger nodding when she told him later, eyes out of focus considering this, it's the damned Calvinist insanity again. Payment. Why must they always put it in terms of exchange? What's Prentice want, another kind of beverage proposal or something? Assign everyone a bitterness quotient? Lovely. Up before the evaluation board, so many points earned for being Jewish, in a concentration camp, missing limbs or vital organs, losing a wife, a lover, a close friend. I knew you'd be angry, she murmured. I'm not angry. No, he's right. It is cheap. All right, but what does he want, then? Stalking now this stuffed, dim little parlor, hung about with rigid portraits of favorite gun dogs that point in fields that never existed save in certain fantasies about death. Lees more golden as their linseed oil ages, even more autumnal, necropolitical than pre-war hopes. For an end to all change, for a long, static afternoon and the grouse forever in blurred takeoff, the sights taking their lead aslant purple hills to pallid sky, the good dog alerted by the eternal scent, the explosion over his head always just about to come, these hopes so patently, defenselessly there that Roger, even at his most cheaply nihilistic, couldn't quite bring himself to take the pictures down. Turn them to the wallpaper. What do you all expect from me, working day in, day out among raving lunatics? Jessica sighing, oh gosh, curling her pretty legs up into the air. They believe in survival after death, communication mind to mind, prophesying, clairvoyance, teleportation. They believe, Jess, and... Something is blocking his speech. She forgets her annoyance, comes up out of the fat paisley chair to hold him, and how does she know? Warm-skirted thighs and Mons pushing close to heat and rouse his cock, losing the last of her lipstick across his shirt, muscles, touches, skins confused, high-blooded, knows so exactly what Roger meant to say. Mind to mind. Tonight up late at the window while he sleeps, lighting another precious cigarette from the coal of the last, filling with a need to cry because she can see so plainly her limits, knows she can never protect him as much as she must from what may come out of the sky, from what he couldn't confess that day. Creaking snow lanes, arcades of the ice-bearded and bowing trees, the wind shook down crystals of snow, purple and orange creatures blooming on her long lashes. And from Mr. Pointsman, and from Pointsman's, his obliqueness whenever she meets him. Scientist neutrality. Hands that... She shivers. There are chances now for enemy shapes out of the snow and stillness. She drops the blackout curtain. Hands that could as well torture people as dogs and never feel their pain. A skulk of foxes, a cowardice of curs are tonight's traffic whispering in the yards and lanes. A motorcycle out on the trunk road, snarling, cocky as a fighter plane, bypasses the village, heading up to London. The great balloons drift in the sky, pearl grown, and the air is so still that this morning's brief snow still clings to the steel cables. White goes twisting peppermint stick down thousands of feet of night. And the people who might have been asleep in the empty houses here, people blown away, some already forever, are they dreaming of cities that shine all over with lamps at night? Of Christmases seen again from the vantage of children and not of sheep, huddled so vulnerable on their bare hillside, so bleached by the stars' awful radiance? Or of songs so funny, so lovely or true, that they can't be remembered on waking, dreams of peacetime? What was it like before the war? She knows she was alive then, a child, but it's not what she means. Wireless, staticky Frank Bridge variations, a hairbrush for the tangled brain over the BBC Home Service, bottle of Montaché, a gift from Pirate, cooling at the kitchen window. Well, now, in his cracked old curmudgeon's voice, palsied hand reaching out to squeeze her breast in the nastiest way he knows, girlie, it depends which war you mean. And here it comes, ugh, ugh, drool, welling at the corner of his lower lip, and over and down, in a silver string. He's so clever, he's practiced all these disgusting little... Don't be ridic, I'm serious, Roger, I don't remember. Watches dimples come up either side of his mouth as he considers this, smiling at her in an odd way. It'll be like this when I'm 30. Flash of several children, a garden, a window, voices. Mummy, what's... Cucumbers and brown onions on a chopping board, wild carrot blossoms sprinkling with brilliant yellow a reach of deep, very green lawn, and his voice. All I remember is that it was silly, just overwhelmingly silly. Nothing happened. Oh, Edward VIII abdicated. He fell in love with... I know that. I can read magazines, but what was it like? Just damned silly, that's all, worrying about things that don't... Jess, can't you really remember? Games, pinafores... Girlfriends, a black alley kitten with white little feet. Holidays, all the family by the sea, brine, frying fish, donkey rides, peach taffeta, a boy named Robin. Nothing that's really gone that I can't ever find again. Oh, whereas my memories... Yes, they both smile. One took lots of aspirin. One was drinking or drunk much of the time. One was concerned about getting one's lounge suits to fit properly. One despised the upper classes, but tried desperately to behave like them. And one cried, wee, 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 all the way. Jessica breaking down in a giggle as he reaches for the spot along her sweatered flank he knows she can't bear to be tickled in. She hunches, squirming, out of the way as he rolls past, bouncing off the back of the sofa, but making a nice recovery, and by now she's ticklish all over. He can grab an ankle, elbow. But a rocket has suddenly struck. A terrific blast quite close beyond the village. The entire fabric of the air, the time, has changed. The casement window blown inward, rebounding with a wood squeak to slam again as all the house still shudders. Their hearts pound, eardrums brushed taut by the overpressure ring in pain. The invisible train rushes away close over the rooftop. They sit still as the painted dogs now, silent, oddly unable to touch. Death has come in the pantry door, stands watching them, iron and patient, with a look that says, "Try to tickle me." 1. TDY, Every Action Ward, St. Veronica's Hospital, Bone Chapel Gate, E1, London, England, winter 1944. The Kenosha Kid, General Delivery, Kenosha, Wisconsin, USA. Dear sir, did I ever bother you, ever, for anything in your life? Yours truly, Lieutenant Tyrone Slothrop. General Delivery, Kenosha, Wisconsin, USA. Few days later, Tyrone Slothrop, Esquire, TDY Abreaction Ward, St. Veronica's Hospital, Bone Chapel Gate, E1, London, England. Dear Mr. Slothrop, you never did. The Kenosha Kid. 2. Smartass Youth. Oh, I did all them old-fashioned dances. I did the Charleston, and the Big Apple, too. Old Veteran Hoofer. Bet you never did the Kenosha Kid. 2.1. S.Y. Shucks, I did all them dances. I did the Castle Walk and I did the Lindy, too. O.V.H. Bet you never did the Kenosha Kid. 3. Minor Employee. Well, he has been avoiding me, and I thought it might be because of the Slothrop affair, if he somehow held me responsible. Superior, haughtily. You never did the Kenosha Kid think for one instant that you... 3.1. Superior, incredulously. You? Never. Did the Kenosha Kid think for one instant that you? 4. And at the end of the mighty day in which he gave us in fiery letters across the sky all the words we'd ever need, words we today enjoy and fill our dictionaries with, the meek voice of little Tyrone Slothrop, celebrated ever after in tradition and song, ventured to filter upward to the kid's attention. You never did... The Kenosha Kid. These changes on the text, you never did the Kenosha Kid, are occupying Slothrop's awareness as the doctor leans in out of the white overhead to wake him and begin the session. The needle slips without pain into the vein just outboard of the hollow in the crook of his elbow. 10% sodium amytal, 1 cc at a time, as needed. 5. Maybe you did fool the Philadelphia, Rag the Rochester, Josh the Joliet, but you never did the Kenosha Kid. 6. Scent and sacrifice, a nationwide observance, fats searing, blood dripping and burning to a salty brown. You did the Charlottesville Shoat, check, the Forest Hills Foal, check, fading now, the Laredo Lamb, check, wait, what's this, Slothrop? You never did the Kenosha Kid. Snap too, Slothrop. Got a hard on in my fist. Don't be pissed. Re-enlist. Snap to Slothrop. Jackson, I don't give a fuck. Just give me my rupture duck. Snap to Slothrop. No one here can love or comprehend me. They just look for someplace else to send me. Dab my head and mic my brain. Stick that needle in my vein. Slothrop. Snap to Pisces. We want to talk some more about Boston today, Slothrop. You recall that we were talking last time about the Negroes in Roxbury. Now, we know it's not all that comfortable for you, but do try, won't you? Now, where are you, Slothrop? Can you see anything? Slothrop. Well, no, not see exactly. Roaring in by elevated subway only in Boston, steel and a carbon shroud over the ancient bricks.
Rhythm's got me. Oh, baby, that swing, swing, swing. Yeah, the rhythm got me, just to thinking that whole wide world can sing. Well, I never ever heard it sound so sweet, even down around the corner on Basin Street. And now that the rhythm's got me, chillin', let's swing, swing, swing. Come on, chillin', let's swing. Black faces, white tablecloth, gleaming very sharp knives lined up by the saucers. Tobacco and gauge smoke richly blended, eye reddening and tart as wine. Yowza, gwine, smoke a little of this high shit. Give the wrinkles in my brain a process. Straighten them all right out, show enough. Pisces. That was show enough, Sothrop? Sothrop. Come on, you guys, don't make it too... White college boys hollering requests to the combo up on the stand. Eastern prep school voices pronouncing asshole with a certain sphinctering of the lips so it comes out asshole. They reel, they royster. Aspidistras, giant philodendrons, green broad leaves and jungle palms go hanging into the dimness. Two bartenders, a very fair West Indian, slight with a mustache and his running mate black as a hand in an evening glove, are moving endlessly in front of the deep, the oceanic mirror that swallows most of the room into metal shadows. The 100 bottles hold their light only briefly before it flows away into the mirror. Even when someone bends to light a cigarette, the flame reflects back in there only as dark sunset orange. Sothrop can't even see his own white face. A woman turns to look at him from a table. Her eyes tell him in the instant what he is. The mouth harp in his pocket reverts to brass inertia, a weight, a jive accessory. But he packs it everywhere he goes. Upstairs in the men's room at the Roseland Ballroom, he swoons, kneeling over a toilet bowl, vomiting beer, hamburgers, home fries, chef's salad with French dressing, half a bottle of Moxie, after-dinner mince, a Clark bar, a pound of salted peanuts, and the cherry from some Radcliffe girl's old-fashioned. With no warning, as tears stream out his eyes, plop goes the harp into the, the loathsome toilet. Immediate little bubbles slide up its bright flanks, up brown wood surfaces, some varnished, some lip-worn, these fine silver seeds dripping loose along the harp's descent toward stone-white cervix and into lower night. Someday the U.S. Army will provide him with shirts, only on the starch in his snow-white arrow to hold the pockets stuck together enough to keep objects from... But no, no, fool, the harp has fallen, remember? The low reeds singing an instant on striking porcelain. It's raining against a window somewhere and outside on top of a sheet metal vent on the roof, cold Boston rain. Then quenched in the water, streaked with the last bile brown coils of his vomit. There's no calling it back. Either he lets the harp go, his silver chances of song, or he has to follow. Follow? Red, the Negro shoeshine boy, waits by his dusty leather seat. The Negroes all over wasted Roxbury wait. Follow? Cherokee comes wailing up from the dance floor below, over the hi-hat, the string bass, the thousand sets of feet where moving rose lights suggest not pale Harvard boys and their dates, but a lot of dolled-up redskins. The song playing is one more lie about white crimes. But more musicians have floundered in a channel to Cherokee than have got through from end to end. All those long, long notes. What are they up to? All that time to do something inside of. Is it an Indian spirit plot? Down to New York, drive fast, maybe get there for the last set on 7th Avenue between 139th and 140th. Tonight, Yardbird Parker is finding out how he can use the notes at the higher ends of these very chords to break up the melody into... Have mercy. What is it, a fucking machine gun or something? Man, he must be out of his mind. 32nd notes, demi-semi-quavers, say it very... Demi-semi-quaver, fast, in a munchkin voice, if you can dig that, coming out of Dan Wall's chili house and down the street. Shit. Out in all kinds of streets. His trip by 39, well begun, down inside his most affirmative solos, honks already the idle, amused, dum-de-dumming of old Mr. Fucking Death himself. End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.
Side 3. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 73. Out over the airwaves, into the society gigs, someday as far as what seeps out hidden speakers in the city elevators and in all the markets, his birds singing to gainsay the man's lullabies, to subvert the groggy wash of the endlessly, gutlessly overdubbed strings. So that prophecy, even up here on rainy Massachusetts Avenue, is beginning these days to work itself out in Cherokee. The sax is downstairs getting now into some, oh, really weird shit. If Slothrop follows that harp down the toilet, it'll have to be head first, which is not so good, because it leaves his ass up in the air, helpless, and with Negroes around, that's just what a fella doesn't want. His face down in some fetid unknown darkness, and brown fingers strong and sure, all at once undoing his belt, unbuttoning his fly, strong hands holding his legs apart, and he feels the cold Lysol air on his thighs as down come the boxer shorts, too, now, with the colorful bass lures and trout flies on them. He struggles to work himself farther into the toilet hole as dimly up through the smelly water comes the sound of a whole dark gang of awful Negroes come yelling happily into the white men's room, converging on poor wriggling Slothrop, jiving around the way they do, singing, "Slip the talcum to me, Malcolm." And the voice that replies is who but that red shoeshine boy who's slicked up Slothrop's black patents a dozen times, down on his knees just popping that rag to beat the band. Now Red, the very tall, skinny, extravagantly conked redhead Negro shoeshine boy who's just been read to all the Harvard fellows. Say, Red, any of those sheiks in the drawer? How about another luck-changing phone number there, Red? This Negro, whose true name now halfway down the toilet, gliding down the crack now toward his asshole, chevroning the hairs along like topo lines up a river valley, the true name is Malcolm. And all the black cocks know him. Malcolm have known him all along. Red Malcolm, the unthinkable nihilist, says, "Good golly, he sure is all asshole, ain't he?" Jeepers, Slothrop, what a position for you to be in, even though he has succeeded in getting far enough down now so that only his legs protrude and his buttocks heave and wallow just under the level of the water like pallid domes of ice. Water splashes, cold as the rain outside, up the walls of the white bowl. "Grab him fo' he gets away. Yowza!" Distant hands clutch after his calves and ankles, snap his garters and tug at the argyle socks Mom knitted for him to go to Harvard in. But these insulate so well, or he has progressed so far down the toilet by now, that he can hardly feel the hands at all. Then he has shaken them off, left the last Negro touch back up there, and is free, slick as a fish, with his virgin asshole preserved. Now some folks might say, "Phew, thank God for that." And others moaning a little, "Aw, shucks," but Slothrop doesn't say much of anything because he didn't feel much of anything. Eh, and there's still no sign of his lost harp. The light down here is dark gray and rather faint. For some time has been aware of shit, elaborately crusted along the sides of this ceramic, or by now iron, tunnel he's in. Shit nothing can flush away, mixed with hard water minerals into a deliberate brown barnacling of his root. Patterns thick with meaning, Burmashave signs of the toilet world, icky and sticky, cryptic and glyptic. These shapes loom and pass smoothly as he continues on down the long, cloudy waistline, the sounds of Cherokee still pulsing very dimly above, playing him to the sea. He finds he can identify certain traces of shit as belonging definitely to this or that Harvard fellow of his acquaintances. Some of it, too, of course, must be Negro shit, but that all looks alike. Hey, here's that gobbler biddle. Must have been the night we all ate chop suey at Foo's Folly in Cambridge, because there's bean sprouts around here someplace, and even a hint of that wild plum sauce. Say, certain senses then do seem to grow sharper. Wow. Foo's Folly. Weepers. That was months ago. Hey, and here's Dumpster Villard. He was constipated that night, wasn't he? It's black shit mean as resin that will someday clarify forever to dark amber. In its blunt, reluctant touches along the wall, which speak the reverse of its own cohesion, he can uncannily, shit-sensitized now, read old agonies inside poor Dumpster, who'd tried suicide last semester. the differential equations that would not weave for him into any elegance, the mother with the low-slung hat and silk knees leaning across Lothrop's table and Sidney's great yellow grill to finish for him his bottle of Canadian ale, the Radcliffe girls who evaded him, the black professionals Malcolm touted him on to who dealt him erotic cruelty by the dollar, up to as much as he could take.